Hey everyone, welcome back and thank you for being here. So it's been, I guess, like four and a half months, maybe 5 months since I've recorded a lecture. And in this episode, we're going to be covering, oops, let's change the layout to side by side. We're going to be covering Emerson's Divinity School Address, or Acquaint Thyself Firsthand with Deity. And for whatever reason, it feels befitting that this lecture happen outside in nature. It's also just a better environment. I'm visiting my dad right now, and I don't want to spend too long on this. I've gotten some feedback that I maybe disclose too much in these lectures, and the intent of that is to help any interested student or colleague or collaborator or someone who wants to learn or just experience this content, do philosophy. I guess I'm an existentialist. I don't think that you can do philosophy except as a human. And it's about the experience of doing philosophy for the philosopher too. So this is fun for me, and I am trying to share that with you guys and bring you along for the journey. And I think that involves being transparent and trying to create some sense of a narrative about what's happening in my own life as this happens. It's not, it's a deliberate pedagogical choice. It's not a lack of focus. I may have said this already, but anyway, so I want to maybe do a little sketch of the future. And if you don't want to hear that, you could probably skip ahead a few minutes. But, over the spring, while I was gone, since the last lecture I've recorded, I attended a lot of conferences. I attended the Central APA in Chicago. I attended the North Texas Philosophical Association again this year for the second year in a row. I attended the Pacific APA online and the New Mexico Texas for the second year in a row. I did a virtual, it was wasn't it was a hybrid. I showed up virtually, but there was an in-person room. Roundtable on modern philosophy and film. And I also got to participate in a pedagogy conference called Educational Excellence Week. Some of these were sponsored by Lone Star College Montgomery, where I teach. I received some travel funding to attend the Pacific APA, the New Mexico Texas, and the North Texas Philosophical Association conferences. That involves some registration costs, as well as mileage in some cases, or hotels, or just for the Pacific, it was just the registration. And other institutions supported me as well. And so I'm going to be thinking all of them and producing kind of summary videos on those. Beyond that, I also have a camping lectureship coming up. I'm going to be recording some nature-based lectures while camping the Rocky Mountains between Texas and Montana for about a month. And that's really exciting, but it's a lot of work as well. And I'm trying to stay focused on all that it entails, because I want those lectures to be really cool. It's going to be a lot like this, but actually with probably further away. I might have to look into some kind of mic system. Or see how wide angle my cameras can go. I'm going to use cameras instead of my laptop for those videos. I normally use a laptop, so I'm not going to be screen sharing. I'll have the book, but you'll be able to see. You should be following along in your own copy as well. Well, hopefully that's fine. Just froze up for some reason. Not sure what happened to the meeting. It looks like we're still here. It looks like we're still recording. So sorry about that, guys. And you should see both screens. This is a beautiful little, the multicolored aspect is catching my eye. My screen like blacked out and then went white for some reason. But presumably the recording is fine. So anyway, we're gonna do the lectureship. We'll also be hiking for that, and it'll be beautiful. For that, I'm going to cover Cordova, Leopold, Hooks, Lugones, and I'm gonna check something real quick. And then a book called Thinking in Transit by two of my mentors, Craig and Casey. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So jumping into Emerson, we're about the 5.5 minute mark. I guess I'll try to put that in an annotation or something on the video, or somewhere in the comments. But jumping into Emerson now, we're covering it. We're going to be reading this lecture is also, I guess, part of a 1304 design. So that's what I was doing at that time in my life for you guys that are taking this for a class. It's kind of funny. I just so many directions I face with this work. Introduction to World Religions covers Emerson, so covers Divinity School Address. We'll read it together. There's some guiding questions. There are hummingbirds around. My stepmother keeps a really lovely back porch. I actually helped them build this back porch. We set the posts and put all the wood, and then I spent about a week, many hours a day, staining it. You should be able to see. Yeah, like this is a dark brown that I stained. That was in 2021. Anyway, let's go back to this page so you can see what I'm doing. Okay. That is the wrong year. I'll have to change that. I'm not going to do it right now. It should be the right year on like the annotations. So if you go to the website and you go down to Emerson, you can see them. And it says 1838. I put 2019 because I think that's the copyright at the bottom that I saw at the very end. Copyright Emerson Central. Yeah, 1996 to 2019. So that's why I put that. This one is available as a PDF. I'll show you where to find it online. We're going to start here. This is just the home page. So you go to emersoncentral.com if you wanted to find this information. It's like a online free repository of Emerson works. One of the most famous is Self-Reliance. We're not going to be reading that one. I might lecture it later. It's a good one. Basically just says one of my favorite lines from it. It's not very far into it. It says, if you don't write what you believe, tomorrow you'll be reading in the paper what you knew was true, but were too afraid to like claim was true. There's a hummingbird. I don't know if I can. No, it flew away. They're sensitive. They don't like to be seen. So he lived from 1803 to 1802. Instead of reading this little short about, we are going to dive into this deeper one, learn more. And then after we cover this, we will start with the actual philosophical essay that he wrote. One of them, the one that we're covering, right? About divinity, God, deity, truth, spirit. And whether the question, yeah, it doesn't. Well, the what is the relationship between deity, spirit, truth, and direct experience? I think the best answer to this for number one is that he says that basically an evil deed or an immoral deed will shrink the soul and make you cower from yourself, and basically seems to diminish your consciousness and your sense of perception and the richness with which you're willing to show up and see the world, how much you dissociate or feel the need to dissociate. The lies you may have to fabricate or other kinds of like Freudian delusions. And this is pre-Freud, of course. He doesn't say all of this, but this is his way of talking about the enlargement or the diminution, the augmentation one way or the other, the growing or the shrinking of the soul. But the soul is not just this abstract thing. It's the thing that you are, that I am. And so the richness with which we can show up to ourselves is a matter of deity or religious import for Emerson. And so we'll see why. I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects about this text. But overall, it covers basically religious anarchism. And sort of has a deep association between nature and religious experience, immanent out, not out there, but through with everything, something more connected. So let's read the about. I actually haven't covered. I didn't go through this beforehand. Not the about me, or not the, or the about Emerson. And so I'm not quite sure what we're gonna find. I mean, I glanced at it to like see, hey, this is definitely relevant. I'm very I've read this one like so many times, so it's just the like biography that I'm not as familiar with. Let's begin. Ralph Waldo Emerson, born in Boston on May 25th, 1803, was one of the most influential writers and poets of his time. After graduating from the Harvard Divinity School, so this is where he goes back to give this address in 1838, he began his career as a Unitarian minister on March 11th, 1829. So the Unitarian tendency makes a lot of sense given what his argument will be in the Divinity School address. In the Divinity School address in 1838, he is presumably either 34 or 35, based on his birth date there. And so we'll keep going. At just 26 years old, when he began his career as a Unitarian minister, he became a senior pastor with an annual salary of $1,800, comparable to $44,867 in today's 2024 dollars. And so I guess they've, I've pretty sure I've read, accessed this website. But like we saw, the copyright was 2019. So it's very interesting that they are so active with updating this. Shortly after his appointment, Emerson married 18-year-old Ellen Tucker. Tragically, their marriage lasted only 2 years as Ellen succumbed to tuberculosis before her 20th birthday. She endured the illness throughout their entire marriage. Her final words were, "I have not forgotten the peace and the joy." Emerson was deeply affected by Ellen's death, frequently visiting her grave and writing her letters. Her passing led him to question his role in the ministry. Yeah, this actually really closely mirrors my own experience with beginning. I began teaching fourth grade in the spring of my 27th. I was 27 and a half. And basically a week later, my former partner, who I lived with for 3 years, passed away, as I've discussed before. I'm actually going to go visit her grave today. So, always a little bit better, always a little bit. The grief is, if I haven't said it before, I think grieving others is also grieving our own time passing, which is probably one of the things Emerson tries to restore to us. Is a gratitude for our time. Her passing led him to question his role in the ministry. He once declared at her grave, "To be a good minister, I must leave the ministry." Emerson sought the funds Ellen had left him to support himself outside the ministry. Her family initially refused, leading to 5 years of legal battles until he was granted $11,674.79, equivalent to $318,314 in 2024. With this financial security, Emerson became a wealthy man. Emerson began questioning many aspects of the Bible and considered some revelations worn out. This led to his development of transcendentalism, which emphasized individualism and the belief that organized religion and political parties were corrupt. So when I discuss religious anarchism in our guiding questions, Emerson would call this transcendentalism. And the belief that transcendentalists believed people were at their best when self-reliant and independent. This philosophy was the foundation for Emerson's renowned essay on self-reliance. Read more at Emerson about Emerson's life. More hummingbirds. They're really cool because I see all sorts of birds, but they're like so small, and they can just stay in place, and they're like really delicate and pretty. Okay. Got to move something around. Can I make it smaller? Change the size. All right, floating meeting controls. Yay! Cool. Okay. This is a long biography. This could be fun. We're not going to do it here. But this is definitely like some content to come back to if we want to. Okay. What did Ralph Waldo Emerson write? Ralph Waldo Emerson was a 19th century American essayist. So remember, that means 1800 to 1899. 19th century American essayist, lecturer, and poet, considered a leading figure of the Transcendentalist movement. His prolific body of work includes one, essays, two, poems, three, lectures, four, journals, and five, letters. So for essays, again, essays, poems, lectures, journals, and letters. He wrote essays that were prose. He wrote poems that were poetic, had stanza breaks probably, maybe even rhymed. He gave lectures, which may have been more vernacular or colloquial in their delivery or phrasing. He kept journals, which may have been either personal or meant for public consumption. I sometimes also try to organize my research in a way that would be discernible for public consumption later, because I know I can't cover everything that I discern, and I know that it's pretty much all important. And letters, like emails. I mean, you didn't write emails, right? But you can think today of how this would be. So for essays, Self-Reliance, The American Scholar, Nature, and Compensation are among his most famous compositions. And we're not reading any of those. These essays express Emerson's philosophy on na life, nature, and individualism. Emerson wrote two poems. Emerson wrote several poems, including the Rhodora, Brahma, and Uriel. His poems are characterized by their religious themes and celebration of nature. Let's see if these are long, and if they're not, we might do them. Not long at all. What about Brahma? Not long at all. All right. Brahma. If the red slayer think he slays, or if the slain think he is slain, they know not well the subtle ways I keep and pass and turn again. Far or forgot to me is near, shadow and sunlight are the same. The vanished gods to me appear, and one to me are shame and fame. They reckon ill who leave me out. When me they fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt. I am the hymn the bundle sings. The strong gods pine for my abode, and pine in vain the sacred seven. And thou, meek lover of the good, find me and turn thy back on heaven. I like that. Though not as famous as Self-Reliance or Nature, Emerson's The Rhodora feels like a hidden treasure, a B-side that quietly lingers after the last track. In just a few stanzas, the poem captures a profound idea. Nature's beauty doesn't need an audience to be meaningful. Emerson stumbles upon a solitary Rhodora flower in the woods, isolated, leafless, yet blooming with vivid purple petals. Beside a dark pool, and asking, why does beauty exist where no one seems to notice? Emerson's conclusion that beauty is its own excuse for being teaches us to see the sacred and what's overlooked, to honor the modest and the remote, and to find spiritual richness in the humble corners of the natural world. Ultimately, the Rhodora serves as a poignant reminder to appreciate and cherish the beauty and diversity of the natural world. I give my take on what I believe is the true meaning of this poem. It's somebody else's take. Okay, I want to double check that we are still recording. I, hope that it actually is recording properly, and it'll find out when I go look at the thing afterwards. I'm not going to stop and stitch this together. So, this person thinks that the Rhodora by Ralph Waldo Emerson is a poem that reflects the beauty and significance of the Rhodora flower. Emerson, the poem's speaker, stumbles upon Rhodora in the woods and is struck by its vivid beauty and fragrance. The speaker ponders the flower's purpose and reflects on the idea that it exists solely for its own sake and not for the benefit of humans. Despite its small size and insignificance, the speaker sees the Rhodora as a symbol of the power and majesty of nature. The flower is a reflection of God's love and grace, and its beauty serves to uplift and inspire all who behold it. Through this poem, Emerson celebrates nature's beauty and invites readers to look with awe and reverence. If eyes were made for seeing, then beauty is its own excuse for being. All right. It's pretty short. Let's do it. And we're not going to probably not going to do all this extra stuff.
On being asked, whence is the flower? In May, when sea winds pierced our solitudes, I found the fresh verdure in the woods, spreading its leafless blooms in a damp nook, to please the desert and the sluggish brook. The purple petals fallen in the pool made the black water with their beauty gay. Here might the red bird come, his plumes to cool, and court the flower that cheapens his array. Verdura, if the sages ask thee why this charm is wasted on the earth and sky, tell them, dear, that if eyes were made for seeing, then beauty is its own excuse for being. Why thou wert there, O rival of the rose, I never thought to ask, I never knew, but in my simple ignorance suppose the selfsame power that brought me there brought me you, or brought that brought me there brought you. What is the meaning of the poem, the Rhodora? The poem's full title, The Rhodora on Being Asked Whence is the Flower, was published in 1834. So that's the full title right there, on being asked. 4 years before the lecture that we're going to read. Emerson uses this work to explore how nature reveals spiritual truth without needing human praise. Rather than an ornate theological argument, Emerson presents beauty itself as sacred. Beauty is its own excuse for being, suggesting that nature's value isn't measured in human usefulness or recognition. The Rhodora stands in quiet comparison to the rose, admired but often overused as a poetic symbol. Emerson's flower is humble, unassuming, yet worthy of reverence in its solitude. What is a Rhodora flower? This. The Rhodora can be described as a scrawny, deciduous shrub that usually grows to 3 to 4 feet in height. The well-known attraction of the Rhodora is its lavender flowers. In the northern variety, lavender blooms are especially showy. Texas Rhodora. I think I've seen some of these recently. There is this one. It hadn't really blossomed yet. I don't think that's really it. This one, maybe? Like that? I've definitely seen like these recently. So pretty. Okay. Where is the setting of the poem, the Rhodora? The narrator of the famous poem by Emerson is located outside in the springtime in the New England area and has found a beautiful Rhodora plant spreading its leafless blooms in a damp nook and is reflecting on the ability to bring beauty to such a dismal location and setting. Speculation that what is now the Arcadia National Park in Maine was the location. That's not a complete sentence. Who might the Rhodora have been written for? Red bird is the northern cardinal. Coolest feathers splash about. Since Emerson was a transcendentalist, it makes sense that you would believe nature is emblematic of the true spirit of God. The Rhodora, as a comparison, is seen as a natural form transformed into spirit and thought, shaping Emerson's perception of nature. How does the Rhodora compare to the beauty of nature? The Rhodora plant grows in solitude, apart from other flowers often considered more beautiful. This coincides with Emerson's distaste for the rose. He preferred that which was unique and rare to find. Emerson's The Rhodora contemplates the beauty of a simple flower and its effect on its surroundings. In the poem, it is stated that nature is beautiful and needs no excuse for being. Instead, it should be valued and, in a way, worshipped for what it brings to the human mind, eyes, and senses. For example, the lavender scent of the Rhodora brings calm to those who encounter it. So, in the Cordova lectures that I've been preparing, and how it is the Native American philosophy of V.F. Cordova Vila, it might be Faye. I have it right here. Yeah. Viola Faye Cordova. Such a pretty name. Oh, goodness. Anyway. Let me just find it actually. So towards the end of the book. Coda, Living in a Sacred Universe. The late Tua anthropologist Alfonso Ortiz claimed that all religious concepts were embraced by Native Americans on the grounds that the more religion, the better. The Native Amer the alien religious concepts are seen as additions to Native beliefs and not as explanations nor even equivalents of Native beliefs. The various beliefs are welcome so long as they offer avenues to celebrations of what is seen as sacred. Further down, the complication explanation that arises here is that the Kachinas, even as spirits, are not from another dimension. They are part of this world. They serve to remind us that this world is sacred. This world is worthy of our reverence, awe, attention, and care. They represent those things on which we depend for our continued survival. The butterfly is given a special consideration, for example, because it pollinates the corn that feeds the people. It is not more, but also not less, a sacred being than the corn itself. So I thought that was quite relevant to Emerson, Emerson's transcendental appreciation for nature and matter and experience and being as direct access, direct contact with sacredness or God. Who might the Redor have been written for? Literary critics, e.g., Joel Port and Lawrence Buell, often interpret Emerson's poem as addressing the relationship between humanity and nature, consistent with his transcendentalist beliefs. Some suggest more personal inspiration may also be present. In my view, the Redor could be a metaphor for Emerson's beloved, his wife, Lydia. While there is no definitive biographical evidence that Emerson intended this reading, the poem's intimacy, the idea of something beautiful yet overlooked, and its sense of love that does not demand admiration support this possibility of that interpretation. Emerson disliked the ordinary and the status quo. Just a peek at his transcendentalist beliefs, it's not scooting over, okay, whatever, is solid proof. The rose, too common for Emerson. He sought what was rare or unique. For Emerson, the redor captures feelings for his wife, his lavender petals symbolizing her rare and common presence. Emerson saw his wife as stunningly beautiful, invaluable, and a calming force in his life as a writer. He knows that she was known only to a select few who sought her uniqueness. Such a woman is rare indeed. His poems are characterized by their religious themes and celebration of nature. Lectures. Number three, going back to what did Ralph Waldo Emerson write? Sought after speaker, Emerson's lectures were often published later. Notable lectures include Conduct of Life, Representative Men and English Traits. Yeah, we're not reading any of those either. Four, journals. Emerson kept a diary throughout his life containing many of his profound thoughts and ideas. Five, letters. His correspondence with friends and family offers valuable insights into his life and thoughts. Emerson's works are considered some of the most important in American literature. His ideas on individualism, nature, and self-reliance continue to be highly regarded today. Now, I would say that this demand for the individual freedom and for the self-reliance and especially being put into a position of needing to almost being forced to depend on yourself in order for it to really come out. It's not meant to justify any kind of conservatism or neoconservatism. I think pretty much any safe human needs to be able to manage their own body. And being a quote unquote individual does not make the position conservative, explicitly speaking. Yeah. I think that that's quite divorced from one's convictions about how resources are distributed or what kind of regulations are in place. So when we talk about the individualism here for transcendentalism, it's really an individualism of religious experience. It's really an individualism of religious anarchism. It's really an anarchism. And anarcho-capitalism is more common to hear about than anarcho-communism. But even for Lenin, socialism is what the state does to try to eventually dissolve the state through communism. Which Lenin's argument was that you need to educate a few generations through socialism. So this is what I believe China has basically tried to do. And then in recent years, they've gone away from central control to a more market-based control. And market-based is perfectly in line with anarchism. I mean, you can have a market-based anarcho-communism. The market does not make it capitalist. It has to do with really the level of democracy in the workplace and how much freedom and empowerment the individual, each individual has on average to determine their own outcomes. So it is, again, a sort of anarcho-individualism, right? But one where each individual should become the kind of person that supports the community. Almost in a Kantian way, like that's what the categorical imperative would demand the law be. But another hummingbird. Let's keep going. So his ideas on individualism, nature, and self-reliance continue to be highly regarded today. So my hope again is that these asynchronous or these video lectures are, with my divergences or similar catalogings of what future generations will find useful, what may be lost one day, or maybe obvious. I don't know. The home of Ralph Waldo Emerson. That's pretty. Ralph Waldo Emerson, one of America's most celebrated philosophers, essayists, and poets, lived in a house in Concord, Massachusetts, which played a significant role in his life and writings. He lived there from 1835 until he died in 82. So for 47 years. These are pivotal years during which he wrote many of his most influential works, including essays such as Self-Reliance and The American Scholar. Characteristics and charm. The Emerson House was a large square wooden structure painted in a deep reddish brown hue. It was 2 stories tall, with several chimneys protruding from its roof. So, important to note, I guess, this is in Massachusetts in the north. I don't know. Shame to say, I don't know when slavery was outlawed in the north, per se. I think it was before the Civil War, and I think that's what, obviously caused it. When was slavery outlawed in Massachusetts? 70, 81 to 83. So yeah, I mean, I'm not going to read too much into that, but significantly before the Civil War, significantly before even Emerson was born into that state, Massachusetts, one of the first colonies. And they go to the North and the South of the United States, basically just the Eastern United States. Most of the West had not been territorialized. It's kind of interesting to think about that. You have kind of this cultural and geographic this ecology, basically, I guess is what you'd call it, a spatialized ecology going out into the Rocky Mountains terrain. The West is incredibly arid compared to the East. That's probably one good reason why expansion was halted for so long to create this congestion in the Eastern Americas. It's probably a natural kind of barrier preventing aggressive expansion into the arid West, where you couldn't cultivate crops, things like mining and gold. I mean, coal mining, mineral mining, iron, coal, gold prospecting, cattle. What's the word? Running? Not running. Not herding. Driving. Cattle driving. I used to watch Westerns growing up. Anyway, this is the kind of the time we're thinking about Emerson living in, but in the Northeast for the most part, with some awareness of the manifest destiny kind of violence and genociding. It was a genocide. The diaspora, the displacement, the ethnic cleansing of indigenous communities during the 19th century, Trail of Tears. So yeah, we want to keep all of, and slavery, of course, before the Civil War, Jim Crow after the Civil War. We want to keep, and the unions, I read something, I couldn't remember who it was, but it was about capitalism. It said that the factories in the North could produce 10 bushels of textile in June, as well as in August, as well as in December, as well as in February. So that meant that the South could produce 10 bushels of cotton fresh from the fields at a consistent rate too. And so you can see the way that capitalism forces a sort of normalization of labor output, and often a sort of peak output is mistaken for a consistent output that would never be sustainable. And you get a slash and burn as tech type conquering mode to your economy, where you're just burn and churning labor, people's lives into profit for capitalist class. Which is not to apologize for the South when it comes to, but I mean, I'm just saying that, like, and Marx is writing in this time across the ocean in Germany, and collaborating with other individuals in the European nations, in the communist parties. And the communism was a thing before Marx. There are other anarchists too, like, Kropotkin comes to mind. And I think there are even some very recent ones in the last 20 or 30 years who've done good work about ecology and sort of eco-Marxism, more environmental structures, communitarian ways of rethinking how society could be. And how we might come up with councils for making decisions, distributing resources, considerations of which ethics are at play, which duties or prime directives, like what do we want? We want to maximize individual freedom or self-determination, self-actualization, where you can become whatever you want, or do we want to create some kind of limit on what each person ought to do? And so, anyway. Can't remember that guy's name. So this is all happening at Emerson's time, right? And whatever people may misunderstand about Marx is about liberating the worker. So, and restoring the worker from a sense of estrangement and alienation from their work, from their daily life, from their grief, from the time that's already gone past them. The rooms were spacious with high ceilings, large windows, and classic period furniture. It boasted a welcoming ambience with many books and artifacts reflecting Emerson's broad interest in intellectual pursuits. The house for the location, the house is on the Cambridge Turnpike in Concord, Massachusetts. This town in itself has immense historical significance, having been a focal point during the early days of the American Revolution. Emerson's home is not far from other historically significant sites, such as the homes of Louisa May Alcott and Nathaniel Hawthorne, as well as Walden Pond, made famous by Henry David Thoreau, a close friend of Emerson. Overall feel and impact on his writings. Concord's tranquility and natural beauty, along with its historical resonance, profoundly influenced Emerson's writings. He was surrounded by an environment that nurtured intellectualism, transcendentalism, and deep reflection. The natural landscapes around Concord, especially places like Walden Pond, were consistent with Emerson's reverence for nature as expressed in his essays and lectures. Within the walls of his home, Emerson entertained many notable figures of his time, including Thoreau, Alcott, Hawthorne, and Herman Melville. The exchange of ideas in these gatherings indeed fueled Emerson's philosophical musings. Emerson's home was not just a physical dwelling, but a reflection of his inner world. The serene soundings, the rich intellectual atmosphere, and the history embedded in the town of Concord all converged at this home, making it an epicenter of metaphysical thought and American intellectualism during the 19th century. How cool. So we'll save this for later, the longer thing, if we do other lectures on Emerson. So back to the guiding questions. What is the relationship between deity, spirit, truth, and direct experience? Two, how does Emerson argue that we have misunderstood Christianity? Three, which two benefits does Emerson argue Christianity offers us as starting points, even though we've misunderstood it? Four, quote, "And now, my brothers, you will ask, what in these desponding days can be done by us?" So again, what in these desponding days can be done by us? That's the question for number four. And number five, the task, not so much a question, but the task is to explain religious anarchism and relate it to transcendentalism. So we'll try to tackle these as we go. If I don't give you an explicit answer, I'm not going to sweat it. You shouldn't either. If you're in one of my classes, you only have to answer one or two of these, really just one of these questions, in one to two sentences. Just pick one question, answer it in one to two sentences. Give an example or something like that, but keep it short. Shouldn't be more than 50 to 100 words, I would imagine. Maybe not even, yeah. So, cool. About 42 minutes in, and we are going to begin the text. This is the only one we'll do by Emerson for this class, as far as I know. So it's good that we spent some time on his background and a few of his other works. I was happy to take that digression. This text is available. Let's open back up where we were. Oh, not that one. And go to that. Okay. So this text, if you go to Essays and Poems and you go to the Nature Addresses/Lectures, and you go to addresses, not lectures, but addresses. And then you can click Divinity School Address. And this is the same, it doesn't have the pictures, I don't think. But aside from that first picture, it's just pictures of quotes. And it might have the pictures of quotes. But I don't think it has that first picture of the house there. But that is presumably what the Harvard School, the Commons looked like, or whatever, you know, main hall they were having, the lecture hall. It's presumably what the lecture hall looked like. If we try to save the image, maybe it'll give us some kind of title. Yeah, Divinity Hall. So that's Divinity Hall at Harvard. And the summary is also not available in this annotated copy. So let's do the summary too. But yeah, now you know where to find that. If you want the PDF version, go down to Download Complete Essay. It'll open the PDF version in a new tab. And that is the clean version that I have. And as you can see, it doesn't have any of the interject, it has, yeah, that interjection, which is just a repeat of what was already said somewhere, pretty sure. I don't think I saw any other one, maybe one where no other interjections, no images either, no Divinity Hall, but that's what it looks like. That's where you find the original unedited source, and yeah, Emerson delivered his speech before the senior class of divinity students, their professors and local ministers in Divinity Hall at Harvard Divinity College, Cambridge, on Sunday evening, July 15th, 1838. So he was 35, about a 2 months after his 35th birthday. He left the ministry to pursue a career in public writing and public speaking. Okay, here's a summary of the Divinity School Address, provided by EmersonCentral.com. The Divinity School Address is an essay by Ralph Waldo Emerson delivered as a lecture to the Divinity School of Harvard College in 1838. In the essay, Emerson critiques traditional forms of Christianity and religious institutions. and calls for a new kind of spirituality based on individual experience and personal insight. So, as you can see, the guiding questions really center around that. How does he argue that we have misunderstood Christianity? How do deity, spirit, truth, and truth relate to direct experience? Which two benefits does Emerson argue Christianity offers us as starting points, even though he's critiquing it? Why does he still start here? Because he could have started anywhere. What can we do about it? And then, yeah, like, what do we call this? Religious anarchism or transcendentalism or personal insight, personal access to God, intuition, philosophy? Like, what do we call this? Is philosophy a way of accessing the sacredness of God? He argues that organized religion and its institutions have become stale and irrelevant, and that people should seek a deeper understanding of the divine through intuition and experience. Pretty cool stuff. He believes that each person has access to the divine within themselves, and that this inner spiritual connection is more important than any external religious authority. Throughout the essay, Emerson emphasizes the importance of individuality, self-reliance, and self-discovery in the spiritual realm, and calls for a return to a more authentic and personal form of spirituality. By doing so, he challenges the dominant religious and intellectual norms of his time and lays the foundation for a new kind of spiritual and philosophical thought in America. Beautiful. So you can find the PDF. That's Divinity Hall again, one more time. It's big on the screen now if you want to look at it. So. All right. And this is the essay. We're at 47 minutes. In this refulgent, so it's probably 18 full pages. Let me get some water. In this refulgent summer, it has been a luxury to draw the breath of life. The grass grows, the buds burst, the meadow is spotted with fire and gold in the tent of flowers. The air is full of birds and sweet with the breath of the pine, the balm of Gilead, and the new hay. Night brings no bloom to the heart with its welcome shade. Through the transparent darkness, the stars pour their almost spiritual rays. Man under them seems a young child, and his huge globe a toy. The cool night bathes the world as with a river and prepares his eyes again for the crimson dawn. The mystery of nature was never displayed more happily. The corn and the wine have been freely dealt to all creatures, and the never broken silence with which the old bounty goes forward has not yielded yet one word of explanation. One is constrained to respect the perfection of this world in which our senses converse. How wide, how rich! What invitation from every property it gives to every faculty of man, in its fruitful soils, in its navigable sea, in its mountains of metal and stone, in its forests of all woods, in its animals, in its chemical ingredients, in the powers and path of light, heat, attraction, and life, it is well worth the pith and heart of great men to subdue and enjoy it. The planters, the mechanics, the inventors, the astronomers, the builders of cities, and the captains, history delights to honor. But when the mind opens and reveals the laws which traverse the universe and make things what they are, then shrinks the great world at once into a mere illustration and fable of this mind. What am I and what is? Asks the human spirit with a curiosity new kindled, but never to be quenched. Behold these outrunning laws which our imperfect apprehension can see tend this way and that, but not come full circle. Behold these infinite relations, so like, so unlike, many, yet one. I would study, I would know, I would admire forever. These works of thought have been the entertainments of the human spirit in all ages. A more secret, sweet, and overpowering beauty appears to man where his heart and mind open to the sentiment of virtue. Then he is instructed in what is above him. He learns that his being is without bounds, that to the good, to the perfect, he is born, low as he now lies in evil and weakness. That which he venerates is still his own, Though he has not realized it yet, he ought. He knows the sense of that grand word, though his analysis fails entirely to render account of it. When in innocency, or when by intellectual perception he attains to say, I love the right, truth is beautiful within and without, forevermore. Virtue, I am thine, save me, use me. Thee will I serve day and night, in great and small, that I may be not virtuous, but virtue. Then is the end of the creation answered, and God is well pleased. So in a way, you don't become, you kind of lose yourself in God or in virtue. You don't, it's not something that like the ego takes on. It's not a property, but a sharing of God. The sentiment of virtue is a reverence of, and delight in the presence of certain divine laws. It perceives that this homely game of life we play covers, under what seem foolish details, principles that astonish. The child amidst his baubles is learning the action of light, motion, gravity, muscular force, and in the game of human life, love, fear, justice, appetite, man, and God interact. These laws refuse to be adequately stated. They will not be written out on paper or spoken by the tongue. They elude our persevering thought. Yet we read them hourly in each other's faces, in each other's actions, in our own remorse. The moral traits, which are all globed into every virtuous act and thought, in speech we must sever and describe or suggest by painful enumeration of many particulars. Yet, as this sentiment is the essence of all religion, let me guide your eye to the precise objects of the sentiment. By an enumeration of some of those classes of facts in which this element is conspicuous. So the intuition of the moral sentiment is probably one of the better ways to answer number one. And I'll leave it at that for now. I think that I'm not sure that I'll answer much more beyond for number one. The intuition of the moral sentiment, I'm curious what students will write. The intuition of the moral sentiment is an insight of the perfection of the laws of the soul. These laws execute themselves. They're out of time, out of space, and not subject to circumstance. Thus, in the soul of man, there is a justice whose retributions are instant and entire. We should associate this, I think, with karma. I think each person carries their karma, whether they intend to or not. They can't avoid doing so. He who does a good deed is instantly ennobled, but this is also this sort of shrinking and enlarging that I discussed before. He who does a mean deed is by the action itself contracted. He who puts off impurity thereby puts on purity. If a man is at heart just, then insofar is he God, right? Partaking of God, not becoming virtuous, but becoming virtue, which is a loss of the independent ego or the independent self. The individual is not necessarily independent. The safety of God, the immortality of God, the majesty of God do enter into that man with justice. If a man dissemble, deceive, he deceives himself and goes out of acquaintance with his own being. A man, in the view of absolute goodness, adores with total humility. Every step so downward is a step upward. The man who renounces himself comes to himself. See how this rapid intrinsic energy worketh everywhere, righting wrongs, correcting appearances, and bringing up facts to a harmony with thoughts. That alignment between harmony and with facts with thoughts, or real the way of reality with the way of perception, is a part of the Dharma, and it's why Dharma refers to both the way of reality and the true understanding of reality, because they should be the same. Not a representation of reality, but the same. Its operation in life, though slow to the senses, is at last as sure as in the soul. By it, a man is made the providence to himself, dispensing good to his goodness and evil to his sin. Character is always known. This is what I'm saying about your karma following you around. I strongly would associate this with Joan Didion's sense of self-respect as well. Thefts never enrich, alms never impoverish, murder will speak out of stone walls. The least admixture of a lie, for example, the taint of vanity, the least attempt to make a good impression, a favorable appearance, will instantly vitiate the effect. But speak the truth, and all nature and all spirits help you with unexpected furtherance. Speak the truth, and all things alive or brute are vouchers, and the very roots of the grass underground there do seem to stir and move to bear you witness. See again the perfection of the law, So all nature comes to help you. See again the perfection of the law as it applies itself to the affections and becomes the law of society. As we are, so we associate. The good by affinity seek the good, the vile by affinity the vile. Thus, of their own volition, souls proceed into heaven, into hell. And also through interpretation of your experiences, the specific hermeneutics of what you notice or what you don't notice, and how anxious or poorly you experience a situation, or how gladly and confidently you experience a situation, are generally reflections of your sense of virtue and character. Your sense of conviction. These facts have always suggested to man the sublime creed, that the world is not the product of manifold power, but of one will, of one mind, and that one mind is everywhere active in each ray of the star, in each wavelet of the pool. And whatever opposes that will is everywhere balked and baffled, because things are made so and not otherwise. Good is positive. Evil is merely privative, not absolute. It is like cold, which is the privation of heat. All evil is so much death or non-entity. Benevolence is absolute and real. So much benevolence as a man hath, so much life hath he. For all things proceed out of the same spirit, which is differently named love, justice, temperance. In its different applications, just as the ocean receives different names on the several shores which it washes, all things proceed out of the same spirit, and all things conspire with it. Whilst a man seeks good ends, he is strong by the whole strength of nature. Insofar as he rose from these ends, he bereaves himself of power of auxiliaries. His being shrinks out of all remote channels. He becomes less and less a mote, a point, until absolute badness is absolute death. Sometimes I think of the economy this way. The direct relation between like what resources we have access to and how kind we're being to ourselves and to each other, how much we're not wasting, how hard we're working, and how much we're sharing, those things. Good ends, meaning providing for oneself and for others, and working, not in any kind of capitalist way, but doing something that is intended for the edification of oneself and others. Whether that's the edification of the soul, shelter, food, future food like crops, technology. There's lots of ways to edify the health of a society and empower society. But when you see the resources dwindling, try to work towards those. There are, now the other ways, the privation, these are like periods of non-production, where former productions are tried to be are squeezed for further profits, or other people's labor is administrated or managed, imprisoned, occupied, as in the case of Gaza by Israel, and the genocide against the Palestinians there, and the West Bank and the Golan Heights, I believe is the name. Surveillance without actually doing any work generally is not going to add value. Now, surveillance, insofar as it doesn't become a replacement for genuine work, can possibly maintain regulations. If not surveillance, then like good structures that are working. Right, because like if you create a structure and the structure in itself is not surveilling but functioning well, and there is a way to profit from that structure without having to continue to do any new work, then insofar as that profit from that structure becomes a replacement instead of being distributed through the structure and to the or to other participants in the structure, insofar as that is owning that structure or being the one in charge of that structure, as a manager, as a teacher, what have you. These can be necessary power levers, They should not become replacements for an individual body performing work and continuing to grow, continuing to have religious experience, continuing to edify themselves and others. Because the tightening grip and the micromanaging of trying to take a past labor and squeeze more out of it, or trying to regulate the labor of others, with newer and more clever systems, this cleverness, it creates efficiency, but it can't go on forever. And it doesn't have much consideration for human well-being or the need for rest. Like I said, the factory operating this churn and burn style made the fields and the workers, the slaves of the fields, the chattel slaves of the fields, operate in this churn and burn style. Yeah, like that demand for efficiency, that plantation desire to avoid work, that factory owner desire to avoid work. While a man seeks good ends, he is strong by the whole strength. And the reason I'm talking about this again is to talk about what kinds of ends you seek, and how Emerson would argue that they impact. I don't, think Emerson had others under his control. I assume he made his income from lectureships, but I don't know. The perception of this law of laws awakens in the mind a sentiment which we call the religious sentiment, in which our highest happiness, and which makes our highest happiness. Wonderful is its power to charm and to command. It is a mountain air. It is the embalmer of the world. It is myrrh and storax and chlorine and rosemary. It makes the sky and the hills sublime, and the silent song of the stars is it. By it is the universe made safe and habitable, not by science or power. Thought may work cold and intransitive in things and find no end or unity, but the dawn of the sentiment of virtue on the heart gives and is the assurance that law is sovereign over all natures, and the world's time, space, eternity do seem to break out into joy. So sometimes law with a capital L is associated with the one, the absolute, good, deity, truth, spirit, or God. This sentiment is divine and deifying. Deifying meaning that it makes of something of oneself or of the experience a deity or a very sacred experience. It is the beatitude of man. It makes him illimitable. Through it, the soul first knows itself. It corrects the capital mistake of the infant man who seeks to be great by following the great and hopes to derive advantages from another, by showing the fountain of all good to be in himself, and that he equally with every man is an inlet into the deeps of reason. When he says, I ought, when love warms him, when he chooses, warned from on high, the good and great deed, then deep melodies wander through his soul from supreme wisdom. So there's this personal aesthetic edification. Then he can worship and be enlarged by his worship, for he can never go behind the sentiment. In the sublimest flights of the soul, rectitude is never surmounted, love is never outgrown. This sentiment lies at the foundation of society and successively creates all forms of worship. The principle of veneration never dies out. Man, fallen into superstition, into sensuality, is never quite without the visions of the moral sentiment. In like manner, all the expressions of this sentiment are sacred and permanent in proportion to their purity. The expression of this sentiment affects us more than all other compositions. The sentences of the oldest time which ejaculate this piety are still fresh and fragrant. This thought dwelled always deepest in the minds of men in the devout and contemplative East, not alone in Palestine, where it reached its purest expression. The very interesting thing here is that Emerson is writing this. I mentioned Israel's occupation and genocide against Palestine, the Nakba in 48, advances in 67, 68, and 69, I think, conflicts with Lebanon, the Cold War in the late 90s or the mid early 90s, later in the late 20th century. And recent attacks against Gaza, starving citizens, withholding aid, killing flotilla participants, double tapping ambulances, shooting children in the leg for coming too close to the border fences because they set the rules and they didn't follow them. Emerson's writing before all of that. He's also writing before Israel was created in 45, and land was taken from Palestine, before the British colonization, I believe, of Palestine. Which, British mandate of Palestine is early 20th century, I think. And Zionism as an ideology, I believe, starts in the 1890s. Right? So when we critique Israel and we critique Zionism, we're critiquing forms of statism, again, emphasizing religious anarchism, emphasizing individual anarchism, direct access to God, respect for the individual, not occupying the another person, not controlling them. We're critiquing Zionism as a form of colonialism, as something that depends on the displacement of people that were already indigenous people that were already there. And if not the displacement, then a disavowal of their way of life and an active destruction of it. Deconstruction is too neutral of a term. Not alone in Palestine, where it reaches its purest, where it reaches its purest expression, but in Egypt and Persian, India and China. And there's some, reference, there's some fetishization, racist fetishization of, quote, Orientalism. Europe has always owed, and this is the part that is prejudiced, Europe has always owed to Oriental genius its divine impulses, but it's prejudiced in kind of a way that says, like, Eastern philosophies or Asian cultures figured things out first and Europe took it, Europe stole it. What these holy bards said, all sane men found agreeable and true. And the unique impression of Jesus upon mankind, remember Jesus being from Palestine, Jesus upon mankind, whose name is not so much written as plowed into the history of this world, is proof of the subtle virtue of this infusion. So there's definite reference to Jesus throughout. If you have any Buddhist inclinations, you can think of Jesus as a Buddha, and you can take different positions on the need for atonement and the need for Jesus to truly be a different kind of human than other humans. That is to say, that Jesus was also God, and to say that we are not also God, right? For to make Jesus a different kind than us and than what we're capable of. I don't think you need to take a position on that one way or the other. And I think people who think that Jesus was God and we're not are going to be very adamant about that position. I don't, that's not what we're saying here. You can take. So, in other words, that can be true. Jesus can be God. He can still be a Buddha, and we can still be Buddha. But Buddha may be something that is mutually attainable between the two of us, whereas him being God and us not is not. Or you could take the position that we're all God, or it doesn't matter. There is no difference, etc. And he was still a Buddha, right? But the important point is that to think of Jesus's moral perfection is something that we can aspire to. Meantime, whilst the doors of the temple stand open night and day before every man, and the oracles of this truth never cease, It is guarded by one stern condition. This, namely, it is an intuition. It cannot be received at second hand. Acquaint thyself firsthand with deity. Truly speaking, it is not instruction, but provocation that I can receive from another soul. What he announces, I must find true in me, or wholly reject, and on his word, or as his second, be he who he may, I can accept nothing. On the contrary, the absence of this primary faith is the presence of degradation. As is the flood, so is the ebb. Let this faith depart, and the very words it spake and the things it made become false and hurtful. Then falls the church, the state, art, letters, life. The doctrine of the divine nature being forgotten, a sickness infects and dwarfs the constitution. Once, man was all. Now he is an appendage, a nuisance. Right, because the sacredness is gone. And because the indwelling Supreme Spirit cannot wholly be got rid of, the doctrine of it suffers this perversion, that the divine nature is attributed to one or two persons and denied to all the rest and denied with fury. So Emerson does take a position on the divine nature of, so we're not supposed to be separate beings from the kind of being that Jesus was. He's just a really good dude. Like impossibly good. The doctrine of inspiration is lost. The base doctrine of the majority of voices usurps the place of the doctrine of the soul. Miracles, prophecy, poetry, the ideal life, the holy life exist as ancient history merely. They are not in the belief nor in the aspiration of society, but when suggested, seem ridiculous. Life is comic or pitiful as soon as the high ends of being fade out of sight and man becomes nearsighted and can only attend to what addresses the senses. These general views, which, whilst they are general, none will contest, find abundant illustration in the history of religion, and especially in the history of the Christian Church. In that, all of us have had our birth and nature and nurture. The truth contained in that, you, my young friends, are now setting forth to teach. Speaking to that class of 1838. As the cultus or established worship of the civilized world, it has great historical interest for us. Of its blessed words, which have been the consolation of humanity, you need not that I should speak. I shall endeavor to discharge my duty to you on this occasion by pointing out two errors in its administration, which daily appear more gross from the point of view we have just now taken. So, question two: how does Emerson argue that we have misunderstood Christianity? What two errors? This is not the first error, but he will begin in a second. Jesus Christ belonged to the true race of prophets. He saw with open eye the mystery of the soul. Drawn by its severe harmony, ravished with its beauty, he lived in it and had his being there. Alone in all history, he estimated the greatness of man. One man was true to what is in you and me. He saw that God incarnates himself in man and evermore goes forth anew to take possession of his world. He said in this jubilee of sublime emotion, I am divine. Through me, God acts. Through me, speaks. Would you see God, see me, or see thee, when thou also thinkest as I now think? But what a distortion did his doctrine and memory suffer in the same, in the next, and the following ages. There is no doctrine of the reason which will bear to be taught by the understanding. The understanding caught this high chant from the poet's lips and said, in the next age, this was Jehovah come down out of heaven. I will kill you if you say he was a man. The idioms of his language and the figures of his rhetoric have usurped the place of his truth. And churches are not built on his principles, but on his tropes. Christianity became a mythos, as the poetic teaching of Greece and of Egypt before. He spoke of miracles, for he felt that man's life was a miracle, and all that man doth. And he knew that this daily miracle shines as the character ascends. But the word miracle, as pronounced by Christian churches, gives a false impression. It is monster. It is not one with the blowing clover and the falling rain. Going back to that sort of indigenous sensibility about the relationship between nature, experience, and deity. He felt respect for Moses and the prophets. but no unfit tenderness at postponing their initial revelations to the hour and the man that now is, to the eternal revelation in the heart. Thus was he a true man, having seen that the law in us is commanding, he would not suffer it to be commanded. Boldly with hand and heart and life, he declared it was God. Thus is he, as I think, the only soul in history who has appreciated the worth of a man. One, the first defect. In this point of view, we become very sensible of the first defect of historical Christianity. Historical Christianity has fallen into the error that corrupts all attempts to communicate religion. As it appears to us, and as it has appeared for ages, it is not the doctrine of the soul, but an exaggeration of the personal, the positive, the ritual. It dwells with noxious exaggeration about the person of Jesus. The soul knows no persons. It invites every man to expand to the full circle of the universe, and will have no preferences but those of spontaneous love. But by this Eastern monarchy of a Christianity, which indolence and fear have built, the friend of man is made the injurer of man. The manner in which his name is surrounded with expressions, which were once sallies of admiration and love, but are now petrified into official titles, kills all generous sympathy and liking. All who hear me feel that the language that describes Christ to Europe and America is not the style of friendship and enthusiasm to a good and noble heart, but is appropriated and formal. Paint a demigod, as the Orientals or the Greeks would describe Osiris or Apollo. Except with an A. Accept the injurious impositions of our early catechetical instruction, and even honesty and self-denial were but splendid sins if they did not wear the Christian name. One would rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn than to be defrauded of his manly right in coming into nature and finding not names and places, not land and professions, but even virtue and truth foreclosed and monopolized. You shall not be a man evil. You shall not own the world. You shall not dare and live after the infinite law that is in you, and in company with the infinite beauty which heaven and earth reflect to you in all lovely forms. But you must subordinate your nature to Christ's nature. You must accept our interpretations and take his portrait as the vulgar drew it, as the vulgar draw it. That is always best, which gives me to myself. The sublime is expected, and so here he's switching back into instead of a taking up there somebody else's, instead of. In the previous few sentences, Emerson was presenting what he's criticizing from their perspective, and now he's presenting in the new paragraph, he is presenting an alternative or something he agrees with. That is always best, which gives me to myself. The sublime is excited in me by the great stoical doctrine, obey thyself. That which shows God in me fortifies me. That which shows God out of me makes me a wart and a wen. There is no longer a necessary reason for my being. Already the long shadows of untimely oblivion creep over me, and I shall decease forever. The divine bards are the friends of my virtue, of my intellect, of my strength. They admonish me that the gleams which flash across my mind are not mine, but God's, that they had the like and were not disobedient to the heavenly vision. So I love them. Noble provocations go out from there, inviting me to resist evil, to subdue the world, and to be. And thus, by his holy thoughts, Jesus serves us, and thus only. To aim to convert a man by miracles is a profanation of the soul. A true conversion, a true Christ, is now, as always, to be made by the reception of beautiful sentiments. It is true that a great and rich soul, like his, falling among the simple, does so preponderate, that, as his did, it names the world. The world seems to them to exist for him, and they have not yet drunk so deeply of his sense as to see that only by coming against themselves or to God in themselves can they grow forevermore. It is a low benefit to give me something. It is a high benefit to enable me to do somewhat of myself. The time is coming when all men will see that the gift of God to the soul is not a vaunting, overpowering, excluding sanctity, but a sweet natural goodness, a goodness like thine and mine, and that so invites thine and mine to be and to grow. The injustice of the vulgar tone of preaching is not less fragrant to Jesus than to the souls which he profanes. The preachers do not see that they make his gospel not glad and shear him of the locks of beauty and the attributes of heaven. When I see a majestic Epaminondas or Washington, when I see among my contemporaries a true orator, an upright judge, a dear friend, When I vibrate to the melody and fancy of a poem, I see beauty that is to be desired. And so lovely, and with yet more entire consent of my human being, sounds in my ear the severe music of the bards that have sung of the true God in all ages. Now, do not degrade the life and dialogues of Christ out of the circle of his charm by insulation and peculiarity. Let them lie as they befell, alive and warm, part of human life and of the landscape and of the cheerful day. And so, the first is to separate the divinity of humans from and our access to moral knowledge, basically. All right. Third cup of coffee down. I think you're only supposed to have two a day and take 2 days off on the weekends. 5 days on, 2 days off. Max two cups a day. I do not follow that rule. I should. Number two, the second defect of the traditionary and limited way of using the mind of Christ is a consequence of the first. This, namely, that the moral nature, that law of laws, whose revelations introduce greatness, yea, God himself into the open soul, is not explored as the fountain of the established teaching in society. So the second issue is that you don't even get God anymore. Excuse me. Men have come to speak of the revelation as somewhat long ago given and done, as if God were dead. The injury to faith throttles the preacher, and the goodliest of institutions becomes an uncertain and inarticulate voice. It is very certain that it is the effect of conversation with the beauty of the soul to beget desire and need to impart to others the same knowledge and love. If utterance is denied, that thought, the thought lies like a burden on the man. Always the seer is a sayer. Someone who perceives truth wants to share it. Somehow his dream is told. Somehow he publishes it with solemn joy, sometimes with pencil on canvas, sometimes with chisel on stone, sometimes in towers and aisles of granite. His soul's worship is builded. It's not a mispronunciation. Emerson wrote builded. Sometimes in anthems of indefinite music, but clearest and most permanent in words. The man, enamored of this excellency, becomes its priest or poet. The office is coeval with the world. But observe the condition, the spiritual limitation of the office. The spirit only can teach, not any. And he's going to emphasize the ability to preach. He considers preaching the basic act of giving a lecture, which is to say, having experiences, reflecting on one's experiences, and then being able to organize one's thoughts to communicate to others for their edification. Sermonizing. I'm not sure which word he gives it exactly. Maybe sermons. Seminars do this. Lectureships do this. I've had great teachers who do this. I think it's my preferred way to teach. Not any profane man, not any sensual, not any liar, not any slave can teach, but only he can give who has. He only can create who is. The man on whom the soul descends, through whom the soul speaks alone, can teach. Courage, piety, love, wisdom can teach. And every man can open his door to these angels, and they shall bring him the gift of tongues. But the man who aims to speak as books enable, as synods use, as the fashion guides and his interest commands, babbles. Let him hush. To this holy office you propose to devote yourselves. I wish you may feel your call in throbs of desire and hope. The office is the first in the world. It is of that reality that it cannot suffer the deduction of any falsehood. And it is my duty to say to you that the need was never greater of new revelation than now. From the views I have already expressed, you will infer the sad conviction, which I share, I believe, with numbers, of the universal decay and now almost death of faith in society. The soul is not preached. The church seems to totter to its fall. Almost all life extinct. On this occasion, any complaisance would be criminal, which told you whose hope and commission is to preach the faith of Christ. The faith of Christ is preached. It is time that this ill-suppressed murmur of all thoughtful men against the famine of our churches This moaning of the heart, because it is bereaved of the consolation, the hope, the grandeur that come alone out of the culture of the moral nature, should be heard through the sleep of indolence and over the din of routine. This great and perpetual office of the preacher is not discharged. Preaching is the expression of the moral sentiment in application of the duties of life. And how many churches, by how many prophets, tell me, is man made sensible that he is an infinite soul, that the world and heavens are passing into his mind, that he is drinking forever the soul of God? So the not passing into, not creating, he's not creating them. Drinking forever the soul of God. Where now sounds the persuasion that by its very melody in paradise is my heart, and so affirms its own origin in heaven? Where shall I hear words such as in eldritch ages drew men to leave all and follow father and mother, house and land, wife and child? Where shall I hear these august laws of moral being so pronounced as to fill my ear, and I feel ennobled by the offer of my uttermost action and passion? The test of the true faith certainly should be its power to charm and command the soul, as the laws of nature control the activity of the hands, so commanding that we find pleasure and honor in obeying. The faith should blend with the light of rising and of setting suns, with the flying cloud, the singing bird, and the breath of flowers. But now the priest's Sabbath has lost the splendor of nature. It is unlovely. We are glad when it is done. We do make, even sitting in our pews, a far better, holier, sweeter for ourselves, enjoying one's own access to God more readily and more deeply than this deformed church experience. Whenever the pulpit is usurped by a formalist, he's going to critique doctrine, formalism. Whenever the pulpit is usurped by a formalist, then is the worshiper defrauded and disconsolate. We shrink as soon as the prayers begin, which do not uplift but smite and offend us. We are fain to wrap our cloaks about us and secure as best we can a solitude that hears not. I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say, I would go to church no more. Men go, thought I, where they are wont to go, else had no soul entered the temple in the afternoon. A snowstorm is falling around us. The snowstorm is real, the preacher merely spectral, and the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him, and then out of the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had no one word imitating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth. That's what I was saying. That's what preaching is the ability to suffer and share it in a way that others don't have to suffer. To convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. This man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books. He had eaten and drunken. His head aches. His heart throbs. He smiles and suffers. Yet was there not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all? Not a line did he draw out of real history. The true preacher can be known by this, that he deals out to the people his life, life passed through the fire of thought. But of the bad preacher, it could not be told from his sermon what age of the world he fell in, whether he had a father or a child, whether he was a freeholder or a pauper, whether he was a citizen or a countryman, or any other fact of his biography. It seemed strange that people should come to church. It seemed as if their houses were very unentertaining, that they should prefer this thoughtless clamor. It shows that there is a commanding attraction in the moral sentiment that can lend a faint tint of light to dullness and ignorance, coming in its name and place. The good hearer is sure he has been touched sometimes, is sure there is somewhat to be reached, and some word that can reach it. When he listens to these vain words, he comforts himself by their relation to his remembrance of better hours, and so they clatter and echo unchallenged. So you can be a good hearer and still get something good out of a terrible preacher. I need to just pause here for 1 second to check something. Okay, still screen sharing. I'm going to pause the meeting recording for just a minute. For whatever reason, I'm back. For whatever reason, I got worried. I've read this text so many times, I got worried that I'd already recorded this lecture and just forgot about it. Just all seems really familiar. Let's just go back. So, it'll probably take another 20 or 30 minutes to finish this up. I am not ignorant that when we preach unworthily, it is not always quite in vain. There is a good ear in some men that draws, this is what I was just saying, the good hearer, in some men that draws supplies to virtue out of very indifferent nutriment. There is poetic truth concealed in all the commonplaces of prayer and of sermons, and though foolishly spoken, they may be wisely heard. For each is some select expression that broke out in a moment of piety from some stricken or jubilant soul, and His Excellency made it remembered. The prayers and even the dogmas of our church are like the zodiac of Dendera and the astronomical monuments of the Hindus, wholly insulated from anything now extant in the life and business of the people. They mark the height to which the waters once rose, but this docility is a check upon the mischief from the good and devout. In a large portion of the community, the religious service gives rise to th other th quite other thoughts and emotions. We need not chide the negligent servant. We are struck with pity, rather, at the swift retribution of his sloth. Alas, for the unhappy man that is called to stand in the pulpit and not give bread of life. Everything that befalls accuses him. Would he ask contributions for the missions, foreign or domestic? Instantly his face is suffused with shame to propose to his parish that they should send money, 100 or 1,000 miles, to furnish such poor fare as they have at home, and would do well to go the 100 or 1,000 miles to escape. Would he urge people to a godly way of living, and can he ask a fellow creature to come to Sabbath meetings when he and they all know what is the poor uttermost they can hope for therein? Will he invite them privately to the Lord's Supper? He dares not. If he can, if no heart warm this rite, the hollow, dry, creaking formality is too plain, than that he can face a man of wit and energy, put the invitation without terror. In the street, what has he to say to the bold village blasphemer? The village blasphemer sees fear in the face, form, and gait of the minister. Let me not taint the sincerity of this plea by any oversight of the claims of good men. I know and honor the purity and strict conscience of members of the clergy. What life the public worship retains, it owes to the scattered company of pious men who minister here and there in the churches, and who, sometimes accepting with too great tenderness the tenet of the elders, have not accepted from others, but from their own heart, the genuine impulses of virtue, and so still command our love and awe to the sanctity of character. Moreover, the truer, the exemptions are not so much to be found in a few eminent preachers as in the better hours, the truer inspirations of all, nay, in the sincere moments of every man. But with whatever exception, it is still true that tradition characterizes the preaching of this country. That it comes out of the memory and not out of the soul, that it aims at what is usual and not what is necessary and eternal, that thus historical Christianity destroys the power of preaching by withdrawing it from the exploration of the moral nature of man. Where the sublime is, where are the resources of astonishment and power? What a cruel injustice it is to that law, the joy of the whole earth, which alone can make thought dear and rich. That law, whose fatal sureness the astronomical orbits purely emulate, that it is travestied and depreciated, that it is behooted and beheld, and not a trait, not a word of it articulated. The pulpit, losing sight of this law, loses its reason and gropes after it knows not what. And for want of this culture, the soul of the community is sick and faithless. It wants nothing so much as a stern, high stoic Christianity. Sorry, guys, there's a bee. I think it left. I don't want to get stung. It wants nothing so much as a stern, high, stoical Christian discipline to make it know itself and the divinity that speaks through it. Now man is ashamed of himself. He skulks and sneaks through the world, be tolerated, to be pitied, and scarcely in 1,000 years does any man dare to be wise and good, and so draw after him the tears and blessings of his kind. Certainly, there have been periods when, from the inactivity of the intellect on certain truths, a greater faith was possible in names and persons.
The Puritans in England and America found in the Christ of the Catholic Church and in the dogmas inherited from Rome scope for their austere piety. The bee is back. The bee is back. I'm gonna pause this, I guess, guys. Hey everyone. So the bee, I guess, went away. I went inside for a few minutes and I don't see it anywhere. But my family members have showed up again, which means there's probably gonna be some interruptions if I were to try to keep recording, and I've gotta go do something at 5 o'clock anyway. Right now we are at, it's almost five, so I should leave. I don't have time to finish the last, five pages or whatever, so we'll do that in the short part two, if you can hear the dogs barking already. So thank you for being here. Yeah, I think we'll probably start, let's go back and look at this. We'll start back in the middle of page 14, try to recap some of the answers we've got so far, and we'll do 14 through 19. And as you can see, 19 is very short. It's the top third of the page, maybe. So, all in all, we've got about one, two, three, I guess 4 pages, 5 pages. Yeah. 5 pages. All right. So, that's going to be it, guys. Thank you so much for being here. I'll see you shortly in the next video. Take care.